You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Joanne Cornish. Joanne, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Joanne, the way we start the show is with a big question. Who are you? And it's really a way to just start a conversation to kind of get to know each other. What are some of the big pieces of who you are as a person or your commitments or your values that we need to know to start the conversation?
Well, I think I was born in Ithaca, so I have my family's here, most of my family. My parents were first-generation Americans. Like many people, I have Hungarian and Italian immigrant grandparents, mm-hmm. so that's as far back as we go in Ithaca, but my family's been here for over 100 years. I love this community. I have dedicated my life to it. I also have three older sisters and a younger brother. I have two children of my own and two grandchildren, and my mom is still alive. She's 88, and I spend as much time with her as I can. Really, family is the most important thing to me in life. Mm-hmm. Brings me the greatest joy and also the greatest sorrow sometimes. Yep. Can be very sad when you're trying to deal with the issues in your family's lives when you have no control over them. I've been a community activist. I am very involved through my job, in seeing this community grow in a respectful and environmentally sensitive way. It's very important to me. And, you know, it's a hard question. Who are you?
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I thought about it for a long time, really, who I am. But I guess I identify mostly with being a part of a family, part of a unit. I have a wonderful staff that I work with. We're friends. I love to go to work each day. And so those are the things, really, that I guess define who I am at this point in my life.
Yeah, kind of a whole life. Which is good, except when it's not.
Exactly.
And hopefully, that's not too much of the time.
Yeah. No, not too much of the time. Yeah. It's a pretty nice life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So you brought some music with you.
I did.
What would you like to start with?
Why don't we start with, let's see, the 59th Street. No, that's one we're going to end with.
Right.
I'm sorry. Let's start with Moondance, because that's another kind of upbeat song.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And is this just fun music for your life? Some guests pick the soundtrack of their lives, and some guests just pick music that they love.
You know, I love LPs. We still have a turntable. We have about 1,000 albums. And when I am cleaning or at my home, which I love to be home, I play music, and these are the music. This is the kind of music I play, and it makes me happy.
Here we go.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance, with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance 'neath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. Yet all the night's magic seem to whisper and hush. Yet all the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. With you, my love, can I just make some more romance with you, my love? Well, I wanna make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time is just right, and straight into my arms you will run. And when you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own. And every time I touch you, you just tremble inside. Then I know how much you want me that you can't hide. Can I just have one more moon dance with you? My love, can I just make some more romance with you, my love?
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Joanne Cornish. And so, Joanne, what were some of, given who you are now and what you've learned in life, what were some of the experiences, or what was, you know, what were some formative times that helped to kind of bring things into focus that you now know that are kind of at the core of where you are?
Well, it's interesting when you begin to review your life in these terms to sort of come up with an answer. You know, we had a very typical household growing up. You know, my parents were typical, you know, 50s parents. My mom always wanted to be more American than she was raised, because she was raised very much Italian. Uh-huh. And so there were always, like, you know, meals on the table with sort of Betty Crocker meals. And
an effort to be common.
Yeah, exactly, to be American. She wanted to be American. And so she always baked cookies. And you know, my dad was blue collar. He lived kind of a rough life, but he was a good dad. He had some issues, which, you know, I think as we grow, we begin to understand what we didn't understand growing up, and I think that definitely forms, you know, begins to help you form the person that you want to be. And I knew that, you know, my mom was very strong, and I wanted to be a very strong woman, and we didn't really have a choice. We also, you know, my parents didn't have an opportunity to attend college. Their parents didn't believe in it. And in my house, everyone was going to college from the time we were five. That was just a part of our life.
And that was your father and your mother's decision? Well,
absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Uh-huh. And so, you know, we always had to put money away for college and birthday money and that kind of thing. And so that really started to set the stage for the life that I would eventually lead. And I did go on to college, and all of my siblings did. We all are very successful in our careers. Parents were very proud. My father died at 52. So
he barely saw you launched.
He didn't see me launched, really. And for that, I'm a little bit sad, because he would have been so proud of all of us. But my mom, she's still there, and she's still very strong. And then, you know, when I went to college, growing up in Ithaca, you don't have a lot of exposure to a lot of things. I don't know that I knew a lot of Jewish kids. I knew a few, but it wasn't a part of my life. I went to Catholic school. I was raised in a Catholic household, and went to college and met my husband, who was Jewish, mm-hmm. and from Long Island, and parents from Brooklyn, and it was so eye-opening. There was just such a wonderful world out there that I knew nothing about. The opera, the ballet. I mean, those are things that, I mean, my parents were like chubby checkers, and, you know, and I can remember them dancing in the living room with their friends. And so it was a completely different world for me. And my husband through the years has been so supportive, and I feel that I'm very successful, but I don't think that would have happened without him. He always was there to support me, to guide me, to discuss with me things. And to this day, we're still really a partnership.
Right. I want to go back to your parents' story just to kind of explore a little bit. You wanted the strength of your mother, but you had to push back against her conformity, is what I'm hearing, or at least her tendency to want to take her strength in that direction. What did that look like? How did that play out?
You know, I'm the youngest of four girls.
And then you have a younger brother?
And I have a younger brother, who I was sort of the apple of my parents' eye till he was born.
And then you got uprooted.
Yeah, the boy came along, and he was, you know, that was it. It was all over for me. But I always got along really well with my parents. I learned from my siblings. I learned what not to do. And I was always really open and honest with my mom. Mm-hmm. And my dad was pretty strict. And so whenever I wanted anything, I'd go to my mom. Right. And we were always allies. She was always on my side. And there was never really any pushback. You know, when I think back on it, there was definitely an expectation that you went to college, you got married, you had children, you had a family. So there was a little bit of a tension there, because right. On the one hand, you go to college, you do all these things, you want a career, but you also have to be that family person. So that I struggled with over the years, and I think as a lot of women my age do. But with my mom, You know, I followed in her footsteps. She was a really good, loving mother. And I learned from that, and I think I was able to even do a better job because there was our household was a little more stable than the one I grew up in. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. So it was really, she taught me a lot about how to be a good mom and a good person.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that one of the indicators of difference, probably 50 or 70, you know, 50 to 60 years ago, Ithaca wasn't particularly as Jewish as it is now. And by the estimates that I can come up with, we're 10 to 15% people who are Jewish, most of whom are secular, non-religious Jews.
Right.
But that would not have been true prior to the influx of people who remained in Ithaca after the 60s and 70s, which when that demographic was what likely changed, even though there was always a faculty and a high number of Jewish students at Cornell. But that number really took off. And we're now very similar to New York City in terms of the relative balance, although, you know, we don't necessarily perceive ourselves that way.
Yeah, no, it's true, though. And, of course, we are non-practicing Jews. We raised our children Jewish because although I was raised Catholic, it never took with me.
Never resonated with you.
No, never did. Never did. So my husband felt as though he wanted to raise the children Jewish, and we did. So we were part of the Reform Temple. Mm-hmm. And then once they had their bar and bat mitzvah, yeah, they kind of went their own way too. But we felt as though at least we gave them that, you know, sort of that foundation to move on in life.
Right.
And, of course, now it is. There are many more Jews and many more Jews that we, of course, interact with and know, and it's a pretty strong community. So,
and there's half a dozen congregations, depending on how you count them, which is
that's exactly
unheard
right.
of 50,
yeah,
40 years ago.
Exactly. So, so it's been a part of our younger adult life, mm-hmm. Not so much now, but right. I was very much involved in the temple and my kids' Jewish education. And now looking back, I think, oh my gosh, so they were Jewish when I was in high school, but it was just not anything that we even recognized. It was so foreign.
Right, right. Well, this is something that a lot of outsiders don't necessarily perceive about Ithaca because they think it's rural, like much of other rural New York or even Pennsylvania, which is much more religious. Ithaca was kind of pretty anti-religious for a long time. It was not a topic that you could discuss openly. Even though there was a Protestant congregation in town with over 2,000 members in the early part of the 20th century, that was First Pres. It was the largest congregation in town. But that was not something that was really discussable, and there was tremendous animosity. There was no chaplain at the hospital until the 1990s, late 80s
or
90s.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you're right.
Because there was this real distrust and bordering on hatred. And I experienced it as a kid coming to Cornell in 1976, where if you raised anything that was spiritual or religious in nature, whatever the background, you could be laughed at in class by the faculty as well as the other students because it just wasn't discussable. But I grew up in a really progressive but very low church, very almost anarchic Christian community, part of the rural cooperative movement. Mm-hmm. And the president of the National Farmers Organization was a member of the community I grew up with, even though over half of that congregation were very poor people.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's just, you know, so Cornell was an odd place. It didn't fit. But Ithaca is coming into its own with more openness towards religion now than it had 30 or 40 years ago, which I think is a pretty dramatic change.
I think it is a pretty dramatic change, and I think there was a time when you were almost looked down upon when you talked about being part of a religious organization.
You were dumb.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. And growing up, you know, really in a Catholic household, going to a parochial school, you did learn to stop. The minute I hit public school, that was it. I didn't talk about it anymore.
Right.
You know,
right.
Although they knew that, you know, those are the Catholic school kids. But that's really when
it was a badge of dishonor to some extent.
Kind of. Yeah exactly. Yeah. And So I think that's part of the reason today I've just completely grown out of it. Mm-hmm. Intellectually, I can't embrace religion as a core of my life. Spirituality is another thing.
Right, right.
But organized religion.
Right, and I think, but it's not a rejection of organization per se.
No, not at all.
And what's interesting is The word religion comes from a root which means to religament, to bind together again that which is broken
Makes
apart.
Mm-hmm.
So from my kind of practical social science background, your religion is what you do when your world falls apart. So you
tell me what you do, and you've
told me your religion. And a lot of people claim one thing, or they claim to not be religious, but everybody has the stuff that they do, most of which is not empirically justifiable, or at least research-based. It is empirical because it's based
absolutely.
In their lives.
Absolutely, yes.
So it's just an interesting, and in this conversation that we've just had is possible now in a way that it wasn't possible 30 years ago.
I think that's very true. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think you're absolutely right.
I want to go to music. What should we go to next? What would be transition from your parents and your family's house to your own even?
To my own. How about this? I'll do a shout out to Van Morrison. How about Crazy Love?
Here we go.
I can hear her heartbeat from a thousand miles. Yeah, the heavens open every time she smiles. And when I come to her, that's where I belong. Yet I run into her like a river song. She gave me love, 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 love. She gave me love, love. Sense of humor when I'm feeling low down. Ooh. Yeah, when I come to her when the sun goes down. Ooh. Take away my trouble, take away my grief. Ooh. Take away my heartache in a night like a thief. She gave me love, 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 she gave me love, 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 crazy love. Yeah, I need her in the daytime. Yeah, I need her in the night. Yeah, I wanna throw my arms around her and kiss and hug her, kiss and hug her tight. Yeah, when I'm returning from so far away, she gave me some sweet loving, brighten up my day. Yeah, it made me righteous. Yeah, it made me whole. Yeah, it made me mellow down into my soul. She gave me love, 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 crazy. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love. She gave me love, 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 crazy love.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Joanne Cornish. Joanne, I'm pronouncing that right.
You are. Okay. Thank you.
We didn't confirm about that.
No, that's absolutely right.
So what I wanted to ask next was, you said you take a certain amount of pride in having made your household more stable. Mm-hmm. How did you have to change as a person and as a parent to make the next generation have a more stable or easier time than you had? What needed to change?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, growing up in a household that was, for the most part, stable, we had dinners together every night, but my father had some issues, and my mom tried to hold everything together, and she did a very good job of doing that. But when I got married...
And he didn't live long enough to get past his issues. Because a lot of men do that. By the time they hit 60, they finally get past some
all of the and he was the youngest of five children, I believe, and was sort of discarded in his family, and so he carried that with him. But unfortunately, or fortunately, he went to a detox hospital, veterans hospital, and was able to kick some of his habits, and he lived for 2 years after that. So he saw himself sober, and he saw himself as the person I think he always wanted to be.
And you saw him that way,
and we saw him that way too. And so, but when I married, my husband is not a drinker. I like wine, and so he's always the designated driver. For that, I really appreciate it. But I knew that in our household, with our children, those types of things could not ever be overshadow the core value of the family. Mm-hmm. And so both my husband and I worked really hard to make sure that our children were always given the confidence that they needed, and we worked with them. My parents were wonderful. They were always at every game, every play, every event. But there was also that sort of their generational thing where, you know, they would say like, okay, you know, go play, come back when it's dark, and you're 5 years old and you go out on the streets and you play. And then, but that's the way it was. Everyone did that.
Right. And that's kind of being a negative extension of them. And sometimes in that generation, you were an extension. So your successes were their successes, and they could,
Exactly. And with our family, we were so involved in our children's lives, and we only had two kids. So that, was made a little easier. We just knew that we wanted them to have the confidence they needed, to know that life isn't always easy, but we would always be there for them, love them unconditionally. There was always, instead of, you know, we didn't tell them they were nincompoops or whatever, you know, because parenting changed over the years, and my parents did a wonderful job and the best they could, but we definitely, both my husband and I, were the fourth child, and so we have a lot of commonalities.
The fourth of five.
So, you know,
I'm the sixth of seven or the seventh of eighth, because one
died. So there's a lot of commonality in the family dynamic, and so I think that commonality brought us close early on in our relationship.
I want to explore something, because you used a phrase and you said it one way, but I think you meant it slightly a different way. And this is just my guessing, because I don't know.
Go ahead.
That you wanted to give them confidence. And one of the things that I've seen about confidence is that the kids with the greatest confidence have the space to have developed it pretty much on their own, but they're not alone. Mm-hmm. There's somebody kind of just outside the perimeter keeping an eye.
That's exactly right.
And so they're falling down and they're getting up in as much they can, so that they do develop the resilience and the confidence that they carry. But it's not giving it to them, but it's giving them the space to learn.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And our son is a chef, and in our our upbringing, and of course, we always expected our children to go to 4-year colleges, go on to get masters. And my son, when he was 14, he said, "I want to go work in a restaurant." And he did. And then when he graduated high school, which was, you know, I blessed the earth that day he graduated,
because it wasn't clear
that it wasn't always a sure thing. Right. And he said, "I don't want to go to college. I want to be a chef." Mm-hmm. And we said, "Oh, Sam, why don't you go to college and go for 4 years and learn the business, and then, you know, and then you can go on to culinary school." And he said, "Well, if you make me go to college, I'm going to join the army." So I said, "Okay, let's go to culinary school. No college. So those are the types of things. I mean, we definitely allowed them to make their own decisions moving forward. But we were always there to support them, to pick them up, love them unconditionally, no matter what happens in their lives. And you're right. You got to give them space, but you got to be there.
You got to be
him.
Within spitting distance.
Absolutely, and we still are. And my son is 30, and my daughter's 32. But we're there for them every step of the way.
Neat. So in it's really, I think there's pride, and there's a sense of accomplishment. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way, but just in a you know, wow. That job is largely done. Mm-hmm. It's never done because we're always going to have children. Right. Our adult children are always our children, and we're always their parents, regardless of where
we're at. That's very true.
But
you know, just knowing that they're really good people, they have a really good work ethic, they're good parents, that's something to be very proud of because, you know, we were lucky in a sense, but we also worked really hard to make that a reality.
Right. I'm going to want to pick up some of the kind of the politics and the planning and the kind of issues that you're connected with in a minute, but I'm going to do the station ID and we're going to play another song.
Okay.
So you think about what we're going to play and I'll do the station ID.
All right.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report and our guest on this hour is Joanne Cornish. So what should we play?
How about, since we have this crazy weather lately, You Love the Thunder, Jackson Brown.
Oh, yes, and we had quite a storm yesterday.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
To WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and Joanne Cornish is our guest. So, Joanne, I'm gonna actually ask a slightly different question than what I had thought I would. How have you, over the course of your life, how have you had to change or been presented with situations that you've had to radically adjust your understanding or figure out how to respond differently?
Well, that's a good question. And in my certainly my professional life as a public servant, I come.
And what is your role? Because I mean, I know. Yeah.
Yep. So I am the director of planning and development for the city of Ithaca, and the name of our department is planning and development, zoning and building, and economic development. Right. So it's a whole host.
The whole schmear.
Yeah, it's the whole schmear, and so. you know, I have a staff of about 25 people. The building, we have a building division, a zoning division, and the planning division. And so we deal a lot with people all the time that have very different views and very different beliefs and values and on how specifically how the city should be growing and moving. You know, people are very passionate about Ithaca, and people are very vocal, and they're also very educated, which creates some days which are just unbelievable.
And I would say that educated is a euphemism for intellectual.
Intellectual, yes, that so, is yes, yes.
Because it's a.
You're right. It is different, and I'll probably get called on the carpet for that one. But you know, over the years, I really do try to see everyone's point of view. Truly, I do. I am not embedded in any one specific area or belief. But I do try to take into account and see all sides and try to find balance in what people believe or what they bring to me. And again, I'm talking about the job related.
Right.
A lot of people don't want to see Ithaca change. They don't want anything new to come. Mm-hmm. And I know that you can't be stagnant. You've got to move forward. And you should do it in, you know, I have a degree in environmental science. And so I am I started my career as an environmentalist in the work that I did. So I try to bring that to everything we're doing here. And there definitely, you know, there are, you have to strike a balance. And a lot of people don't understand that there is, you know, we have a tax base that's dwindling. We need to keep that tax base strong. We know that we have limited land, so we have to go up. People don't like high buildings.
Right.
People don't want to see things torn down. College Town right now is undergoing a massive transformation. And I myself, having grown up here and spent a lot of time at the university and on the Hill, am sad to see a lot of structures go, but that's progress. And you know, those are old wood frame buildings. Students live in those. They're fire traps. So there's a lot of things you have to consider. And when people bring their concerns to me, and sometimes tearfully, mm-hmm. I try to understand instead of, and that has come with maturity, I think, that you begin to really understand where people are coming from and you feel their pain and you try to give them the best answers that you can. Sometimes you won't please them. But
people can often accept what they don't agree with if they understand why.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's a very important part of my job is just being able to explain why we're doing what we're doing. The other thing, it's okay. I've learned this in my job. It's okay to say, I don't know the answer to that, but I can find out. And that's something I think that comes with maturity.
Yep.
Because you just want to be like, I know everything, but you don't. And it's okay to say, I don't know, but I'll find out for you.
Or I'll try to find out. I mean, some questions are profound enough or they're complex enough that there is no answer.
But at least if someone feels they're being listened to and respected, I think that makes a big difference in how they accept what you're telling them.
What kind of irritation or discomfort caused you to become more skillful at these things? What was the motivation to become more clearly empathetic towards people that you couldn't necessarily satisfy, but you wanted them to, you wanted to respect their humanity? What were the things that made that clear to you?
Well, partially, I think, is that, you know, I do understand my role as a public servant, and everyone has a stake in what we see around us. Also, I love this city. I mean, this is my home. Everything I've done in my work, and I've been doing this in Ithaca now for 25 years, I've done the best that I can do for this city. And knowing that we have a political aspect, and then we have the public aspect, mm-hmm. You know,
there's technical aspects.
There's so many factors involved. And I think when, you know, I worked for a wonderful man, Thijs van Kort, who was the director of planning for many years. And he was kind of an old hippie, you know, always in a very much on the liberal side. But I was able to sort of take his sort of liberalism and sort of maybe form it into something that was a little more helpful. It was actually productive, and moving forward.
What can you explain what that what you mean by that? How did it become more productive?
So
what was it?
So there are a lot of people who want to just say yes to everything because you know, Ithaca is a very sort of liberal community, and you want to please everyone. And I think I realized, oh gosh, a while ago now that I can't please everyone, and the direction we're moving in is many factors are putting us are moving us forward in a certain direction, and so I want people to know that we understand them, that we're concerned about their feelings, and be able to give them solid answers. But you still do have to move forward, and sometimes it's hard,
right?
And the big boxes was probably one of the pivotal points in my career. First one to come through the door. Well, there was the Walmart fight, the original Walmart fight. And my core belief system was that I didn't want them either. I didn't want them in this community. But at the time, our mayor, Ellen Cohen, was, you know, we're going to go bankrupt. We got to do something.
Right. And we're also not, we're missing all the tax revenue that comes
from
the outside.
That's exactly right. So I had to put, and people were really cruel to me during that time because they felt, I mean, I was a target.
You're betraying.
I'm betraying that. But I knew the reasons why we were doing this. And I knew that if we didn't do it, they were going to go right outside our borders. We would suffer all of those impacts, and we would see none of the benefit.
And you'd seen it happen with the mall.
Exactly. So, you know, that was a pivotal point in my career. And that's when I got really, really thick-skinned. And I can say that because I still, to this day, I will listen to the criticism, but without knowing the full picture, people don't really understand. So if I can explain the full picture, they can choose to do with that what they want.
Right.
But really, in the end, the big boxes saved our economy, and they've allowed us to do other things.
Right, right. And there was good evidence. I mean, my doctorate is in community and economic development.
Okay,
from Cornell.
So you know.
And when we ran the numbers in the mid-90s, we discovered that there was a niche exactly the size of one Staples store. But after Staples moved in, the others thought they could do it too, but that's not how big the niche was. And we knew it from having compared other university county economies that was the size. That evidence could have been used to help another industry figure out this is not the best choice we could make.
That's right.
Those buildings have been through multiple uses because of that.
Right.
But there is a role for planning, and it's for understanding our problems.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to be in a culture where the rhetoric is, let's all come together so we can have a common ground or a common understanding. We're probably never going to have a common understanding because we want different kinds of lives.
That's exactly right.
But we have a common challenge that we have to live with.
Mm-hmm.
And if our politicians and our business leaders and our religious leaders would frame these issues more as challenges that we will each approach in our own ways, we could probably work together more effectively.
No, I think that's very true. And I think part of the magic is to find that common ground and then work from there.
Right. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to shift the rhetoric from common ground to common challenge.
Because the
challenge allows us to say, this is going to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to hurt everybody differently. But it's whether we need revenue.
Mm-hmm.
We can't build 25% more housing like we need in the county in the next generation.
That's right.
Or we maybe need right now, depending upon how you run the numbers. We can't do that instantly.
That's right.
And it's going to cause pain.
Yep.
But the pain is we have lower tax revenues, and we have higher rents, and we have people who can't live anywhere near their work. And we have schools that are losing students that ought to be picking them up because we have the capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. All of those things.
Yes.
You're right on.
And but we have to live with the pain. So how are we going to share this
so
that we can get some of the things that we desperately want and other people, and we lose some things that we value, but other people get things that they need, and we know who they are. We know who their faces are.
That's right.
We know who we've hurt and helped, and we've done both to everybody.
That's very true. That's a very good point.
Anyway, I'm preaching and I don't.
No, that's fine.
That's
fine.
Another hat. So you were talking about how we're having a sidebar conversation in terms of the religion, and there is a distrust of institutions now that is so incredibly powerful, and there is also an effort to try to force people in a particular direction, whether it's on the right or the left, mm-hmm. without really appreciating that we are all going to suffer and thrive in very different ways. And you used the rhetoric of having to find a way to be in the middle. Mm-hmm. What kind of progress can we make to push that middle out? I mean, I believe that we can frame challenges so that we could get 70, 80, 90% consensus on what the challenges are without having to get consensus on what the solutions are. Because if you can get some consensus on what the challenges are, you can carve up an environment so different groups can approach them in ways that fit their values and their needs. But we don't do that.
And you know, if you listen to the right and you listen to the left, the challenges are the same, basically. Mm-hmm. It's just coming at it from a different perspective.
And how would you characterize the similarity of the challenges?
Well, I mean, I think on both sides, we're worried about global warming. Well, most of us are worried about global warming.
Serious business folks are worried that they're not going to be able to maintain their corporate processes if they don't have the product or they don't have the markets.
That's exactly, right. And also, you know, I think both sides are very concerned about unemployment in America, homelessness in America.
Income inequality even.
Exactly. So those are some of the beliefs on both sides. How do we get them to, you know, my thing is always, you know, you see people out there, you know, protesting, and it's a wonderful thing that this country allows us to speak our mind. But I often...
Not only allows us, it compels us.
compels us to speak our mind. But I often think, oh my goodness, if we just could put that energy into a more productive use. Still protest, and that's fine. Carry signs, do it. But also, I mean, if we could put some of that energy into childhood hunger and literacy and those types of things, where as a world or as a country, we could come to some productive use of all of that energy that would help the country. I don't know how we do it. Right. But I often think, is this just a waste of energy? You know, thousands of buses going to Washington, making their voices heard. That's fine. It's good. And they need to hear that. But I also wish that some of that energy could be harnessed and we could put it into something that would really help our country.
Right. This is something that it's going to sound more off topic than it mm-hmm. is.
That's okay.
There's an article in the Times today talking about an initiative where people in a village, I believe in Kenya, are receiving the equivalent of $22 a month. Mm-hmm. And this is among the poorest of the poor, so it lifts them out of abject poverty. Mm-hmm. They're guaranteed that for 12 years. There are no strings on how they use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can figure out the strategy to improve their lives.
Right.
And what you're talking about here is the same sort of thing. How can we unleash people acting on their own behalf with regard to those people that they see and who can impact their lives so that they make it better for themselves and everybody else? We have a really hard time framing problems to get it, to drill it down. This mm-hmm. is not about voluntarism.
Right.
This is
no,
not
it's
about,
not.
This is
no.
about having a sense of how action is coordinated without being overly planned.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Absolutely.
And we have to talk to each other to figure that out.
We have to talk to each other. And I think part of being in the middle is being able to talk to both sides.
But I hear in your voice, you wanted to find a more effective way to do that. And it's not obvious.
It's not obvious. It's not obvious. And, you know, it seems very daunting. And how does one person start to do that?
Well, one doesn't. But I think we need to think together. And this is part of where my organization, Shared Journeys, this is part of what we do,
mm-hmm.
Is to try to figure out how those conversations could be productive so that people could take action that would benefit themselves and others without having to overly coordinate
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
overly plan it. Because we don't necessarily want the same lives, but we have to not undermine each other.
Right.
And we
yes.
have to not waste our energy fighting each other when that wastes resources and skill and emotion.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly the point.
I want to shift gears here and pardon my preaching because this is a passionate moment
okay.
for me on these kinds of issues. Let's shift gears though, because we're coming down to the last 15 minutes
okay.
of the show.
Sure.
What is it that you do to restore yourself? How do you take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, and how do you know you need to do that?
Well, that's a great question. And you know, I talk to people all day long. I make decisions all day long. I calm people down. There's so much energy I put into my days with my professional life, that I am the type of person that has to have quiet time, has to have alone time. my husband finally, I think, understands that. My kids
do. It takes decades, by the way, for couples to figure
this out.
It does.
It does. And so he certainly understands that. But I love where we live. I love the seasons. I take great joy in being outside and
What kind of physical space do you live in?
So we live in it's sort of in a wooded area. We have lots of trees around our house, so it's sort of a little kind of tree house. We have a deck that I love to sit on, and I really just like quiet solitude. I love to take walks in the woods, love to just be with nature. I have a dog. I love animals, and I love to walk my dog in the morning, and about 6 o'clock every morning, watch the sunrise or the snowfall or the rain. But I find that restores me to a lot, and it allows me to face the day. Mm-hmm. I have two grandkids who they're like, it's like a love drug. I can't get enough. They're just amazing and they're exhausting.
And how old are they and how far are you from them?
So both my children, I'm so lucky, are in Ithaca. So my grandchildren are in Ithaca. Uh-huh. And one will be three in March, and the other will be two in April. So I get to spend a lot of time with them.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
And footnote, in New York State, the median distance from mom is 8 miles.
Okay, well,
And 18 nationally, but yeah. 8 miles in New York State.
Well, I'm within 3 miles of my mom and my children, so it's wonderful. That's really great.
That's very sweet.
Yeah,
sweet.
So those are the things I love to birdwatch. I love to, nature is where I find my greatest solitude and quiet and nature, and I'm very happy.
And that is the counterpart to... I mean, it's not what you've described as a person who is a mix of extrovert and introvert, but you have some strong introvert
needs.
Yes,
absolutely.
And that's what you're feeding with that quiet downtime.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you also like to put on the vinyl and clean your house.
Yes, I love to clean my house. Well, you know, when you work so many hours a week and you don't have a lot of time at home, when you can be home, it's just, that's a release for me. I also garden. I am like a really ferocious gardener, and I spend a lot of time outside in the garden. Uh-huh. And so that just brings me really so much joy. Sometimes I have to remind myself that I've been out here for 6 hours. I better, get something to drink.
Right. And this is going to sound stupid because it's something you just experienced, but what is it what makes it joyful for you? When do you realize that you're elated here?
Well, you know, the smell. First of all, the smell of nature. Uh-huh. And I can, every turn of the season, I say, oh my gosh, doesn't it smell like spring? Doesn't it smell like winter? And everyone, I say, I love this time of year. And my family's like, Mom, you love every time of year. Every season is your favorite season. Right. I said, well, you're right. And I love when I'm in the garden, I love the smell of the earth. And I love the smell of the worms and the mulch. And I don't know, there's just something so amazing. And when you feel the dirt in your hands, brings me so much joy. Or I find a rock. I love stones. I love rocks. Collect them all over the world. Every place I've ever been, I bring rocks home. I don't really buy anything. We just went to Sicily, and I went to the beach and collected stones and sea glass. Uh-huh. And I didn't buy anything in Sicily.
Yeah. Yeah. But you brought this home.
And they make me so happy. I don't know, the feel, the touch, the smell. I can't really describe it, but that's what
You have. I mean, it's a visceral response that you have. And one of the things that we we live in a very intellectual community, and people forget that it's our senses and our bodies and these physical reactions that we really need to also take care of.
Absolutely,
and you're doing it. You're doing it, and it's also to me, I will work out on a treadmill just to get a harder workout, but I would much rather garden or clean because it does the same kind of thing to your body as doing the workout if you do it on a regular basis.
And it's sort of instant gratification.
Yeah,
the treadmill is like, oh my God. I should be thin by now.
Right.
Yeah,
I do. I'll never be thin again.
And I do love that instant gratification.
And I just want to, and it's actually, I didn't anticipate this, but what I've discovered when I'm bringing people together who have profoundly different points of view and different needs, when we get them to talk about what they did as play, as children, and what it was and why it was fun, they describe exactly the kind of thing you did with the worms in the soil or the building something, and it engages all of the senses and the smell and sight and sounds, and you can, when they tell the story, it takes you into it with them. So suddenly you have a physical, emotional bond with this person with whom you may have very completely different interests and be in real profound conflict at the same time. So it allows the next, there's a second conversation, which is, what did you learn as an adult that you had fun learning, and how did you learn it? Because oftentimes these things as children, we just compartmentalize them off as children, but we do have things that we've learned as adults usually that we enjoyed. Life isn't just drudgery. And get them to connect in with that, and then get them to talk about the more substantive issues. By that time, there's a rapport, there's a relationship, and
that's
emotion.
That's very true.
For me, that opens the window to this common ground that you were talking about. That's a technique, but it involves stepping out of your substance, your content area, to engage the person as a person.
Yeah, I and that has happened. I mean, definitely. You'd be amazed how many people collect rocks and stones. And when you begin to share that, people I have nothing in common with, I have this conversation now with people, and it's like the excitement comes, and there is some shared joy.
Right.
And you do begin to then build a relationship.
And when you're working with citizens who may be opposed to a development or who may be sponsoring a development, and you walk with them on the site and you talk about what it was like to be outside and play as a child, that allows things
absolutely
to happen that wouldn't otherwise happen.
You're so right. And that is a technique that I use, maybe not so much for my childhood, but something that is a common emotion or feeling that we can begin to talk about. Childhood is a great one.
Right, and it's usually safe. I mean, people have had horrendous childhoods, and they have traumas that makes them hard to talk, and usually you can pick that up on that so you don't go down that path too far before it becomes a problem. But what I'm trying to get at is in this time where we confuse facts for truth. We need to, you know, and then there are the alternative facts, which are not facts at all. But both of those discussions are kind of distractions, because for something to be truthful, there needs to be, intellectually, there needs to be a fact in there somewhere. And then there needs to be some emotional honesty about what it means. And then there needs to be some kind of physical response, because the facts themselves don't move the hearts of men and women.
No, that's true.
But a truth does. But it's not just the emotion, it's the physical response. It's all of those things coming together.
You're absolutely
right.
And
we haven't danced as a public together for decades.
No,
true. But until we set a clear and achievable standard, and that's what I'm trying to propose in the way that I formulated it, those are things that each step you can address. And not put too much weight on one or too
much weight
on the
other.
And many times the people with the alt facts have the emotion right, or they have the physical reaction really clear, but the fact is totally wrong.
Right.
Bogus.
Right.
And we need to allow that kind of space so we can discover what's of value here.
That's a very good message right now. Certainly.
But it came in this conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a message I have, but also emerged in our conversation.
It's true. Yeah. Very true.
As grandma, what do you want, what skill would you want your grandchildren to pick up as people? What would you hope that they could do or be as people, be aware of, be engaged with?
Well, it's the same, I think, as for my own children. I mean, you know, I worry about the world that they're being introduced into, but I want them to be good people. I want them to be kind and compassionate people.
And decisive. I mean, I see, because that's what
absolutely,
that's what you
are too. And strong. Strong. Yeah. But you can be both. Yeah. And I think it's so important to keep your heart and your emotions open so that you can let the world in and you can process it in a way that comes from a place of kindness and not a place of hatred or you know, really be having strong emotions against what someone is telling you or being to you. So that's really what I hope for them, and it's the same I hope for my children. And they're good people, so I think their kids will be good people too.
As you are moving forward in your role, what do you see? You know, Ithaca is, when I talked about this area to outsiders, they don't realize that Ithaca is, you know, 35,000 people, and they think of the town of Ithaca and they conflate the two and the village of Ithaca.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in terms of truth, it's one entity.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of political facts,
right,
they're totally separate entities.
Absolutely.
And we need, and that's one of the things that we need to kind of get clear and honest about, and how. What would you recommend? If you could impact our understanding of ourselves, and let me just back this up a little bit. When I ask students at Cornell, is Ithaca a small town with an urban vibe, or is it a small city with a rural vibe? You can tell where they're from by how they answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
If
mm-hmm.
they're from a big city, it's always a small town.
Right.
If they're from a small town or a rural area of some sort, it's a small city.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's the opposite of what they're from. What could we do to have a better or more accurate self-perception of who we are? Because we've refused to grow up over the last 30 or 40
years.
Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, Ithaca is... It is a small city, and it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of both the beauty and maybe an enigma of living here is that we do have a rural community, and those one influences the other. And I think as we, you know, one of the things that the school district does and all of the sports, regardless of what kind of sport, is it brings the rural and the urban together. I think that's a really important part of this community. And I think we just have to continue to grow, but also, you know, as a political entity, the town surrounds the city. I'd love to see it become one.
Right.
Because I think we can protect what's most precious to us, the agricultural mm-hmm. and all of that, and still see the city grow and still see people have an opportunity to live and work in an area where maybe they don't need a car. I think this is a little different from what you were asking.
But it's
the kind of thing that I'm working towards.
Right. I'm not just asking the abstract, you know, mm-hmm. what's the mindset that could change, but you know, practically it plays out on transport, it plays out on fire coverage, it plays out on police and sheriffs and the possible consolidation
absolutely.
Of those
yep.
departments. But it also means how do we own it?
Yep.
How do we each own our place in a larger environment?
Well, and sometimes it becomes very territorial, which is why we don't make progress.
Right.
But it is a vision of mine to see much more cooperative government, let's say, certainly at just locally.
Joanne, it's been a delight to get to know you.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you.
And we're going to close with the 59th Street Bridge Song, or otherwise known as Feeling Groovy. do you want to say anything about it before we play it?
No, just that it's a happy song, and I hope everybody enjoys it.
Thank you.
down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. Lamppost, what you knowin'? I come to watch your flowers growing. Ain't you got no rhymes for me? Do it and do do, feeling groovy. Da 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 da, feeling groovy. I got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. I'm dappled and drowsy and ready to sleep. Let the morning time drop all its petals on me. Life, I love you, all is groovy.